Rarely does a county clerk make the headlines, especially on a national scale. But in recent weeks, Kim Davis, the county clerk of Rowan County, Kentucky, captured the nation's attention for standing up for her convictions, despite the possibility of losing her job or even going to jail, which for a short time she did. Now, I realize not everybody agrees with the stand that she took, or even the conviction on which it's based, and that's not what I'm going to debate this morning. I do believe, though, that you can agree that it took courage to take the stand that she did. As John F. Kennedy defined courage in the foreword of his book, Profiles in Courage, courage is much more than bravery on a battlefield. It means acting according to your beliefs, whatever the consequences. See, there is a cost to courage. In fact, without a cost, or at least the potential cost, there really is no courage. Now, we call courage by several names: bravery, valor, heroism, fearlessness, nerve. There's even a few nicknames for it: guts, grit, gristle, backbone. But whatever the name, it's never met its match. Courage is another word for inner strength, presence of mind against the odds, determination to hang in there, to persevere, to withstand hardship. It has staying power. As Chuck Swindoll concludes, it is impossible to live victoriously for Christ without courage. Now, there's one such individual who demonstrated courage and the cost of courage in the New Testament. It's the man we know as John the Baptist. And he really lived his whole life courageously. And eventually, the cost of courage caught up to him. Now, we read earlier from Matthew chapter 14. We're also going to be looking at a parallel account in Mark chapter 6, because it brings in some details Matthew does not. By bringing them together, we'll see a fuller account of what happened with John. I'd like to begin with the tenacity of the faithful. John had a tenacity. He had a way about him that he was not about to give up, regardless of what it might cost him. Now, in order to appreciate the courage of John, we need to understand the setting and the characters. And this is going to take a little time, so please bear with me. But I want you to see who we're talking about here and the situation that he found himself in. In the passage in Mark chapter 6, we read about King Herod. Now, I think for most of us, when we hear King Herod, we think of the Christmas story, right? We think of the Herod who wanted to kill the Christ child and sent his soldiers to the little town of Bethlehem to kill any boy babies under 2 years of age. This is not the same Herod. This is, in fact, that Herod's son. The Herod of the Christmas story was called Herod the Great. And he had a number of sons. I think he had as many as 9 or 10 different wives, and they all had a variety of sons. And they all took the name Herod as almost a title, more so than as a name. And so we read about various individuals that were Herod this and Herod that. We're going to come into that in just a moment. Now, Herod the Great, in his early years, was a very skilled, capable leader. He governed all of Palestine under the oversight of the Roman Emperor Augustus. And he worked very hard at making the land beautiful. There were many building projects that he did. And really, the greatest was the temple, which he rebuilt, restored, and made grand. He had created the magnificent port of Caesarea down on the Mediterranean, which increased the commerce into the area. And he even showed character at times. In seasons of famine, he would cancel taxes. Could you imagine that happening today? During one crisis, he even sold his own dinnerware to buy food for the people. And when he was called Herod the Great, that's not a title he gave himself. That's what the Roman historians called him. They acknowledged that he was a very able ruler, but he had very little support in his own land. Herod was an Edomite. He was a descendant of Esau, Jacob's brother. So a lot of your Bible resources will call him a half-Jew. He wasn't even a half-Jew. He was a descendant of Jacob's brother, who were sworn enemies of the Jewish people. And so the Jewish people never really accepted Herod. He was an outsider. He was a foreigner. Worse than that, he was an enemy. And the people never appreciated even the things that he tried to do for them. They saw him too closely aligned with Rome and not Jewish enough in his practices and his beliefs. He was hated as a tyrant, and that even got into the members of his own family. He was so jealous of his favorite wife that on two occasions he ordered that she be killed if he didn't come back alive. And eventually he did have her put to death, as well as her grandfather, mother, brother-in-law, three of his sons, and numerous subjects. During a swimming party in Jericho, he drowned the high priest that happened to be one of his brothers-in-law. The older he got, as his health began to decline, his mental health went as well, and he became paranoid. He was constantly asking permission from Rome to execute one of his sons or one of his family members that he thought was trying to conspire to take his throne. Finally, even Caesar Augustus had to admit, "I'd rather be Herod's pig than his son." That doesn't make sense to us, but in Greek, there's suos and weos. There's a pun there. And also, you know, you could live a long life as a porker in the Herod household because they weren't going to eat pork. So it was really bad there at the end for Herod and his family. One of his sons, Antipater, was killed only 5 days before his father died himself. Now, after Herod the Great died, his kingdom was divided among his three surviving sons. Herod Archelaus, the elder son, whose mother was Samaritan, he was given the territories of Judea and Samaria. Then Herod Philip, whose mother was Cleopatra, he was given the northeast territories of Iturea and Trachonitis. I know that sounds like a disease, but it was a place back then. And then Herod Antipas became ruler over Galilee and Perea. Perea was the land on the east side of the Jordan, north of Judea and Samaria. So these three sons were given parts of Herod the Great's kingdom. Now, Archelaus, the oldest, according to one author, inherited all of his father's vices, but nothing of his greatness. He offended his Jewish subjects so much that after just 10 years, Augustus removed him from power, because if he didn't, the Jews were going to revolt. And that's when he brought in the governors, of which one would be Pontius Pilate, who ruled over Judea during the time of Jesus. Antipas ruled over Galilee. Remember, that's where Jesus was from. That's where 11 of the 12 disciples were from, and where Jesus spent a considerable amount of his life and ministry. So Antipas was in charge of Galilee and also Perea. And this is the Herod spoken of here. It's Herod Antipas. Okay? Now, Matthew describes Antipas as a tetrarch, which literally means ruler of a fourth part. You say, well, wait a minute. There were three sons. But remember that back in those days, the way they would divide up an inheritance is that the oldest would get a double portion. So if you had three sons, you would divide the estate four ways, and the oldest would get two-fourths, and the other two would get one-fourth each. Archelaus, being the older, got Judea and Samaria, while Philip and Antipas got one-fourth each. So you have Herod Antipas is the one that's in charge of Galilee. By this time in Jesus' life, Archelaus is gone. So he's out of the picture, and Herod Philip we don't hear any more about. Now this is where the story gets interesting. Antipas had married the daughter of the king of the Nabataeans, and they were right next to Perea. So it was a neighboring country, it was an Arab nation, and he had married the daughter of the king as a political alliance. It was to keep peace between the nations. It's probably arranged by Augustus, because Augustus needed a buffer zone between the Parthians further to the east. And this marriage would have probably taken place before Augustus died in AD 14. And what we're going to be talking about here happens about 15 or 16 years after that. Now, around the year 29 AD, on a trip to Rome, Antipas comes across Herodias. Now, Herodias was the daughter of another son of Herod the Great. So she's a granddaughter of Herod the Great. And she was married to one of the other sons of Herod the Great. So she was both the sister-in-law and the niece to Antipas. You following me so far? They fall in love. Herodias divorces her husband, the brother, and Antipas divorces his wife, the daughter of the king. And that would come back to bite him, because eventually the Nabataeans attacked him, and Antipas would have lost, but Rome intervened. So it caused a lot of trouble there. And they married each other. So Antipas is now married to Herodias, who is at the same time his niece, his sister-in-law, and his wife. Kind of sounds like a West Virginia version of the Kardashians, doesn't it? And before anybody's offended, I'm from West Virginia, so I'm allowed to say that. So you've got this scandal going on at the head of the government there in Galilee and Perea. And Perea, by the way, is the land where John the Baptist was ministering. So that's where he lived. That was his home area. And John the Baptist couldn't let it go. I mean, this is wrong. You don't just divorce your spouses in order to marry each other within the family. It's just scandalous. It's wrong. And John stood up and said, it's not right. It's not lawful for you to do this. You are going against God's laws. And the way that the Gospels tell it, he didn't just say it once. He was continually saying this. It kept coming up over and over and over. And finally, Antipas couldn't take it anymore. He was afraid that John was going to lead the people against him, because they had a great respect for John, and he recognized that. So he thought, well, I don't want to make him a martyr. I'm just going to put him in prison, and people won't hear from him anymore, and I don't have to either. So he arrested John, and he locked him up. The Jewish historian Josephus tells us that he was placed at the prison at Machaerus. Now, Machaerus was down toward the Dead Sea, away from public opinion, away from where people would even maybe know where he was. Get him off the scene so that nobody can hear him anymore. And he was content to put him in jail. Now, Herodias, the wife, she wanted him dead. It wasn't enough that he was just off the scene. She wanted him dead. In fact, there was one author puts it this way: the only place where her marriage certificate could be safely written was on the back of the death warrant of John. That was how Herodias thought about it. In order for her to have any peace at all, we need to get rid of this guy. I don't like what he's saying. It's too convicting. So instead of changing the situation, we'll just get rid of him. Very typical way for the world to react to the truth. According to Mark 6:19, Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him. But she couldn't because Herod was fearful of the Jewish reaction. And not only that, it says he adds that he liked to listen to John. Even though what John was saying he didn't approve, he still liked to listen to him. There was something about him. I think Antipas comes across here as more weak than really cruel. Of course, Herodias made up for that latter part, but what you see here is a man that's kind of vacillating back and forth. Now, we're not told how long John was kept in prison. I'm thinking it was probably for some time, because Mark records that Antipas liked to listen to him, and so there were opportunities where they would speak. But then, finally, Herodias got her opportunity. And it came when Antipas celebrated his birthday. Now, for us, birthday celebrations are common. I mean, that's just part of our culture. But in the Jewish culture of that day, they didn't celebrate birthdays. Only the Gentiles did. That was something the Greeks did. And your conscientious Jews, they didn't have anything to do with that. But Antipas was really more Gentile than he was Jew anyway. And he really threw a bash. And he invited all the military and political leaders down to Machaerus, down to this stronghold in southern Perea. And they're having a great time. I'm guessing, even though the text doesn't say it, but I'm sure that the wine was flowing and they were all feeling pretty good about themselves. And then Herodias sends in her daughter. Her daughter, Josephus tells us, her name was Salome. Now, this is not the same Salome that you find at the end of Mark's gospel. Totally different girl. Salome was Herodias' daughter by her previous husband. And at this time, she would have been probably between 12 and 14 years old. Young girl. Herodias sends her in to perform a dance before her stepfather and all of these drunken men. Now again, we're not told what kind of a dance it was, but just think about it. Probably wasn't something you would want your daughters to be involved in. But it really pleased the king. It turned him on, something fierce, and he comes out with this great promise. I'll give you anything you want. Up to half the kingdom, it's yours. Antipas didn't have the power to do that, but, you know, he was just trying to sound bigger than he was. And so Salome goes back to her mom and says, hey, he just said this. What do I ask for? And Herodias had her opportunity. She said, you ask for the head of John the Baptist on a platter right now. Do it immediately so he can't back out of it later. So she does. And you can even see in the way that the Greek is written in the gospel account, Salome didn't do this on her own. She was prompted to ask for this. Now, we're told that Herod was troubled. It really bothered him that she would say this because he didn't want to kill John, partly for political reasons and partly for personal reasons. But he had neither the character nor the courage nor the conviction to confess that he'd made a mistake. He had to save face, and so reluctantly he said, go ahead, go take John the Baptist's head, put it on a platter. And that's what happened. And you see the termination of the faithful. He was put to death. One author observes, as humans, we tend to view John's death as a tragedy. But we need to remind ourselves that death is not punishment for one in right relationship with God, but a release from an imperfect life and a transfer to perfection. It is but the door to an eternity of the purest unending delight spent in the presence of our inexpressibly majestic God. And that's true. John was released from his prison. He was released from the suffering and the isolation. And immediately was taken into eternity. But we also learn from this episode that faithful witness to the truth is not always going to bring praise. There's a price to pay. For John, it was the ultimate price. Now, there are some who opt to compromise their convictions. They water down the truth of God so that it's more palatable either to themselves or to people around them. And that might bring peace with man. But if you want to maintain peace with God, that's going to bring you in conflict with man more often than not. When you stand for the truth, people outside the church aren't going to like it. You might even find a few inside the church that don't like it. So the choice we have, do we want to get along with our fellow man or do we want to get along with God? Sometimes we have to make that choice because you can't do both. Are we going to make a stand for Jesus? Or are we going to bow to the pressure that's around us? See, we can't have it both ways. And we shouldn't try. So what you see at the end is a tribute to the faithful. Both Matthew and Mark record that the disciples of John came and they buried the body of their mentor. It's very similar to what Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus did when they went to get the body of Jesus. Because remember, they were part of the Sanhedrin. They were part of the ruling council that had sentenced Jesus to die. And here they are very publicly going and by burying the body, were identifying with him. That was courageous. And these disciples showed courage. And it really was a tribute to their mentor, what they thought of him. Now Matthew adds at the end of verse 12, then they went and told Jesus. I'm sure that they had recognized the respect that John had held for Jesus. And maybe this is an indication that some of them eventually followed Jesus through his final year of ministry. Then you see in verse 13 the reaction of Jesus. When Jesus had heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. I think there were two reasons why Jesus did that. Part of it was caution. He figured if Antipas could do this to John the Baptist, he could certainly do it to him. And he knew that his time wasn't come for that to take place. And I think, too, it probably moved Jesus to know that his cousin, the forerunner, his life had been ended in such a way. Now, many historians agree that John was beheaded in AD 31 or 32. This would be about the end of Jesus' second full year of ministry. And Jesus knew what was coming ahead. Maybe he withdrew from the crowds to prepare himself for what was to be a very contentious, climactic final year of ministry. Now, earlier on, Jesus had given a moving tribute about John the Baptist. It's recorded in Matthew 11, verses 7 through 15. As John's disciples were leaving, Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. What did you go out into the desert to see? A reed swayed by the wind? If not, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in fine clothes? No. Those who wear fine clothes are in king's palaces. Then what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it was written, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. I tell you the truth, among those born of women there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist. That's quite a tribute. Yet he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has been forcibly advancing, and forceful men lay hold of it. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. If you are willing to accept it, he is the Elijah who was to come. He who has ears, let him hear. A moving, powerful tribute given by none other than Jesus himself. I think John the Baptist could certainly be included in any biblical collection of profiles in courage. Throughout his life, he was unafraid to stand for the truth, regardless of whom he was challenging and regardless of the cost. And eventually, his courage cost him his life. As we conclude this morning, I want to return to a statement I made at the beginning. It is impossible to live victoriously for Christ without courage. No, we're not necessarily going to be asked to confront an immoral leader who could literally take off our head. Could be, though. Think of those Christians over in Iraq that are being confronted by ISIS and being told, in essence, renounce your faith in Jesus or die. And it doesn't even have to be a far-off land. Think about the Columbine High School tragedy. I know that was many years ago. But one story that came out of that, you may have remembered or may have heard, was about a young 16-year-old girl named Cassie Bernal. And one of the gunmen walked up to her and literally put a gun to her head and said, "Do you believe in God?" What would you have done? She said yes, and he pulled the trigger. That's here in America. And acts like that are happening more and more. Are we ready for that? Now, maybe it won't be that dramatic, but maybe we will be called to take a stand that could cost us our job. It could land us in jail. That's happening too. It could cost us our friends. It could cost us our family. When the time to decide comes, whose side are you going to stand on? Are we going to take a stand for the truth? Are we going to take a stand for what God says? Or are we going to give in and try to make other people happy and try to save face or save our job or save our friendships or our family or even save our lives? You know what Jesus said about that, don't you? He who saves his life shall lose it. He who loses his life for my sake shall find it. John the Baptist is a living example of that. What about us? Swindoll concludes, God's Medal of Honor winners are made in secret because their most courageous acts occur down deep inside, away from public opinion, hidden from public knowledge. You say, well, honestly, I don't know if I was confronted in that situation what I would do. If somebody came to me tomorrow and put a gun to my head and said, "Do you believe in Jesus?" I don't know what I would do. None of us do, but all of us can prepare. And the way you prepare your courage is commitment. You got to know what you know, and you got to believe what you believe. A.W. Tozer said, it doesn't matter what you believe, it's what you really believe that matters. And what you really believe is the kind of thing you'll stake your reputation, you'll stake your life on. What do you really believe? Are we prepared to act on what we believe regardless of the consequences? Regardless of the cost, are we willing to pay that price? I can't answer that question for you. That's a question that each and every one of us must answer for ourselves. And as we conclude this morning, I want you to ask yourself that question. Am I committed? How committed am I to Jesus Christ? Would I be willing to pay the cost, whatever it might be, to make a stand for Him? I'd like you to turn in your hymnals to hymn number 399. Hymn number 399. I'll go where you want me to go. I remember hearing this during missionary conventions, and usually it's, okay, people, you got to be willing to go off to some far-off jungle and tell people about Jesus. That's not the only thing that Jesus calls us to go. Are we willing to do whatever it takes, whatever the cost, to express our faith and our love for Him? We're going to stand. We're going to sing the first verse. If you have never committed your life to Christ, this would be a great time to do it. I ask you to come to the front. Declare your faith in Him. Boldly announce before these are your friends where you take your stand. Perhaps you would like to come and place your name in membership with this local church. This is your time. As we sing, you come. Take a stand with this church. This is my church. This is my family now. We invite you to come. We'll just sing the first verse.